Hello and welcome to Android Developers Backstage, the podcast. I'm Chad Haas from the Android UI Toolkit team.
I'm Tor Norby from the Android Tools team.
And today we have...
Shumin Jai from Google Research and Android.
Google Research. It's such a nebulous thing. Like, there's so many things going on here.
That's right. It's also known as research at Google, meaning not a particular division or group, but there's advanced exploratory work everywhere in the company.
Okay. So you do research, but usually targeted towards Android then?
That's right.
So you're not working on self-driving cars. You're not working on contact lenses that detect...
Self-driving Android Auto. Is that a thing? I don't know. I did not reveal something because I have no idea.
But not for now, but there could be
okay. Interesting
working.
You know, I've always found that PhDs are just plug and play. You just toss them at any specific research problem, and it's just the same as every other one that they've ever worked on. Haven't you found the same thing?
Well, also known as permanent head damage.
Yeah, okay.
So. That's the abbreviation, PhD?
That is one of them that I've heard.
Yeah.
In fact, that one's new. So a little bit of context. So I had met Shumin years ago. I was at Adobe at the time, I think, and I happened to be working on animations. I don't know how it worked that way. It turns out that all of us work on the same thing over and over and over again. We just keep iterating and refining throughout our lives, and then it's over. I think there was a metaphor in the Brady Bunch movie about that, about the architecture, but I won't get into that. Anyway, so I was at Adobe, and I was working on animations, and I gave a talk on cartoon animations. I was invited by somebody at IBM Research, and I gave this talk to a small group of researchers there. And then afterwards, this person, who turned out to be you, said, oh, would you like to see this thing that I'm working on now? And I went to your office and you showed me some early prototype stuff about gestures on a keyboard. And I thought, oh, that's really interesting. And you talked about how you were doing the work on Android because it's very easy to swap out core components like the keyboard. So it's easy to do this work on this particular platform. And I just kind of logged it in the back of my mind. It had nothing to do with what I was doing at the time. And then like 2 or 3 years later, I was on Android and this person walks in and says, oh, I've met you before. I was at IBM Research. And a little bit later, Gesture Keyboard came out. So all the dots connect. Today.
So you worked on Gesture Keyboard for Android then, the Google Keyboard?
Yes, I led the team doing Android Google Keyboard development for a few years.
Oh, that's pretty cool. I use it every day.
I do, too. I was so happy to switch to gesture typing when that came online from the, you know, sort of peek and poke thing. It's a lot easier, although there's a particular problem that I spoke to you about a few years ago, which is sometimes I'll be entering a long word and I'll get befuddled in the middle of it and I'll forget what the word was or I'll forget what the next letter in the sequence was and then I just run out of ideas and my finger stops. And there's nothing to do except backspace. And I said, okay, well, you came up with a lot of this technology with your team. Surely you know what I'm doing wrong. How do I get around this problem of entering long words? And you said, I backspace and I start again. You just have to get a running start at it. I think that's the approach.
Well, because I assume that you know a lot of people are terrible spellers, right? So you probably are not just demanding the correct spelling of a word to enter it on the keyboard, right?
Right. So the technology can accommodate certain degree of misspelling. Although in the long run, there could be better spelling models built as part of the decoding process.
Right.
So this is pretty much common knowledge now that is in the keyboard area. It's an kind of user interface-driven decoding problem where you have some fuzzy signal from the user expressed in the form of touch points or gesture strokes, and that got decoded against a language model and sometimes also against a spelling model. So a particular way of spelling a word could be a misspelling of the correct form. And that knowledge can be captured by a decoding engine.
Does our keyboard do that? Does it look at the surrounding sentence to figure out which word you must have meant based on the grammatical context?
So the basic technology is called ngram modeling. That basically looking at preceding words that would give you an estimate of a set of words that are likely to follow the preceding word.
I see. So it looks at context before the word.
Right.
Okay.
It is generally speaking,
context of how that person speaks, because it clearly doesn't, because it never lets me enter cuss words. in my sentences. So if it knew me, it would know that that was actually what I was trying to spell.
So when you type the letter F, does it autocomplete the next three characters or no?
No, it doesn't. Never. Never.
Okay, so you got
I type the rest of the letters and it still doesn't complete to
there
that.
There is actually a setting that actually goes back to probably to this discussion over and over. That is, there are features and capabilities in UI in general and in keyboard in particular that people don't easily discover. But you can actually go there. And our challenge is how we design UI that can be more discoverable and well, review itself.
Right. How do you keep up on not just, you know, the best swear words, but also the latest slang?
So the language model can be periodically refreshed or constantly refreshed. That's kind of a product choice. As you alluded to, that the language model would be also stronger if it personalizes to your own writing habit or your own topics and even whom you talk to and things like that. We know that can be done better.
So when someone pauses in the middle of a long word, you go, "We know, Chet." And then you kind of ignore the input for a while and then you resume when they start moving again?
Right. But the primary challenge in there is kind of a product evolution, balancing the concern for privacy and the power of prediction. So the more the keyboard knows about a personal writing habit, ideally having access to all past writing history would give much stronger prediction to bot.
And if you could also tie it in with like the search history, that would be better.
Oh, right.
And everything.
Well, because I remember
they
that.
They could know that this person is currently on meds for like Tourette's syndrome and that swearing is going to be a part of it or just, you know, language that you wouldn't quite expect in any given sense.
Yeah, that isn't what I was going to say. but that's, you know, I'm glad you took it back to swearing again. Now, I think the canonical example for search engines is if you know that this person's a programmer, then the term Ajax, which I guess we haven't heard in years now, right? But at the time,
I remember that
word. Was like a big thing. If you're a programmer, you meant, you know, the JavaScript and DOM thing. But if you were like a soccer fan, then of course you meant the Dutch soccer team, right? So I'm just thinking that if you knew something about this person, you could even understand when they're trying to do a certain word, they're talking about the word cash, you know, for computer science, whereas there would be maybe a different spelling if you were like, you know, I wouldn't say a gambler, right? But there's other similar words that
right. Similarly,
make, yeah.
At a bigram level, if you see language, it could follow by many words. One of the words is modeling, but that's only for specialists who work on speech recognition or keyboard would think that's a common combination. So when you type language, modeling can be either predicted or made easier to write by the decoder. Similar idea. That is, that the more you know about that person, the better a prediction it can make, which can be used, again, for either error correction or prediction.
Right.
Of course, the challenging there is that where you draw the line in terms of respecting users' history and privacy and to what degree you make that accessible to the user themselves. And that's a balance we have to be mindful of.
So do you, if you want to personalize the model, does that mean that you would actually upload their keyboard entry to a Google server or would you do the n-gram computation locally? So there's like no... There's no like direct keyboard, like the letters I write in my Gmail is not going to somehow end up on a server.
Potentially, there are many sources.
Yeah.
The more the better.
Yeah.
And there's only so much you actually write on the phone.
Yeah.
Some people write a lot, yeah. But most people don't write that much.
Right.
So it gives you a limited amount of history to leverage.
Yeah.
But imagine you have access to all your first party or even third party apps. Where you type on social networks or email or even things you receive.
Right. Yeah.
That can all become part of your writing history that can be leveraged with their various techniques to massage that into the language model to do more effective prediction.
I see.
So all the recognition right now is done locally on the device though, right?
That's absolutely, yes.
Okay. But if I understood you right, what you're saying is that you could, if the user is signed in to Google and we can access, for example, I don't know, like the Gmail outbox, right? You could compute n-grams from that you could then give the user on their phone. So it's not like you would monitor what they were doing on their phone, but you could take their written words in theory and you could generate a model that would be better on the phone, for example.
That's right, yes.
That's interesting.
So it's not so much about taking the information that they're typing and uploading that into the central database as it is bringing
what you have.
More information down from a central database.
But on the other hand, you have more power if you upload that to a server where you can do more cleanup, more processing, and maybe some blending to similar users who have speaking words you haven't used yet, but you're likely to use.
Yeah.
And furthermore, more mundane challenge is that what if you change a device? And if your learning start all over, that's kind of annoying.
Right.
So you want it to be able to transfer from one device to another. And of course, going through a server, that would be
For speech, that's what happens, right? When you speak to your phone, that gets uploaded, or some representation of it gets uploaded to a server for better recognition, right?
Speech in general has always been, or primarily in the cloud.
It's better when it goes to the cloud, at least.
And it's also involving lot larger language modeling.
That goes back to your keyboard pause, actually, because I think speech, the issue, I think I'm much better with the keyboard. I don't find myself stopping in the middle. But certainly when I'm starting doing directions, speech directions, I will in the middle of the sentence. And it's really, I think that it's gotten better at not actually putting those ahs and ums into the query, because that used to really ruin everything.
Interesting.
Set alarm for five minutes.
Everybody has pause words that they like use in the middle of like sentences, right? So I wonder, that must be part of the cleanup process. So didn't we, I know like speech is even more intensive and it used to be completely on the server, but now we also do some amount of local processing, right?
Some, like if you say, okay, Google, that's recognized on the device.
Well, I thought we even had special hardware for on some phones so that it can do it in low power mode.
Yes.
But my impression was that a few releases ago, we could also do simple things like setting an alarm. So saying set alarm for 5 minutes, that doesn't necessarily have to go to the server. So you can be offline and still do that one, I think.
Okay, maybe. Sure. Well, let's say that. So so let's take a step back. We were talking about the language model that we're using and how we might have more powerful ones based on, you know, information from the user's account or history or whatever. What do we use as a language model today? Where does that come from?
Again, that's evolving. It can come from many sources.
Mm-hmm.
There's some sensitivity to the language model. The language model's quality has some sensitivity to the corpus or corpora you use in training that language model. And the more the corpus reflect what people are likely to write, the better it is. So the simple things, just use the entire web crawling result to do language model training. And that lots of people do that. But a lot of the stuff, content on the web, are not necessarily what people write.
Okay.
So therefore, you would want your corpus to be as much reflecting the user's writing behavior as much possible.
Okay, so one of the things that I've heard of that can be problematic is when people are multilingual. This, of course, doesn't apply to Americans because there's really only one language in this country. But I have lots of friends that, you know, they're from France and they speak English and French, you know, both of them. You weren't born on these shores, so you don't qualify to her. Sorry. Right? We can tell because you speak another language, though, obviously. So if they're going to, let's say they're talking to another Norwegian friend and they're using English and Norwegian interchangeably, how does the keyboard deal with this information? Is that factored into the language model at all, or is the language model sort of picked on the device and that's really
Well, I can't believe you beat me to this question because I do this all the time, right? So the way it works right now, I can tell you, is you add multiple keyboards. You say, I want both the English and the Norwegian keyboards. And you get a nice little globe icon that it sits next to your space bar, and that's the one you use to switch. That works pretty well, and I'm really impressed that we have language models for like, in Norway, it's not a large country, or, you know, there's about 4 or 5 million people there. Yet we have a really good language model, as far as I can tell. Either that or my Norwegian's gotten atrocious, and I think it's good, and Norwegians are like, no, it's terrible. But anyway, to me, it seems great. But every now and then, so I switch, you know, to Norwegian when I'm talking to, you know, one of my family members.
But you have to switch on a per-word basis?
No, on a per-keyboard basis, right? So, like, I'm switching the whole keyboard over, and then all the keys switch. Well, not all the keys. There's 3 additional keys that show up, right? But then I keep forgetting. So every now and then I start swiping happily, just looking at the keys, not realizing it's gibberish because it's using the Norwegian model to autocomplete English or vice versa. So it would be really nice if this model could be smart enough to go, that made no sense, but the user has his other keyboard where this actually makes perfect sense. Let me switch.
I just picture everything coming out as like emojis for reindeer and lutefisk.
Right. It's a good guess.
Yeah.
It's also possible to actually, if you're only mixing some Norwegian words into English writing, those words can become part of your own language model for English, but it allows you to write words that is so-called OOV out of vocabulary initially, but they become learned OOV words.
Is that just that, like my possible. Name? Like my name is now in the vocabulary that knows OOV.
Yeah. So that can do that. But more generally, it is also possible to mix multiple languages into one so that you can write both. And then there will be certain degree of confusion. And this,
when you're saying possible, are you saying, hey, this is a theoretical possibility, or are you saying our keyboard can do this?
Our keyboard can do this if we choose to make it do this.
Okay, but I see. That's small matter of coding. Okay, got it.
Yeah.
More than that, it's also a matter of design.
I see.
That is, there's, for a lot of things we said so far, there's a flip side.
Yeah.
That is, quote-unquote, intelligent user interfaces, when they work, you like it.
Yeah.
But when it fails, you disproportionately hate it.
Yeah.
And that is the curve we have to manage very carefully.
It's like the uncanny valley of UIs.
Exactly.
It seems like, the problem, one of the problems would be, okay, now you just doubled your possibilities and you're going to make the wrong choice really quite often now. Right?
That's
like
right.
If you're going to have to take that fuzzy information from what they, mistyped or gestured on the keyboard and apply it to such a large vocabulary, how are you going to guess?
Yeah, and you're generally speaking for myself, you're generally not mixing 50-50. Yeah. It's usually you're in one language, but there's some words that are, not, in that language. There's a better word, borrowed foreign word for it, right? Yeah. So I remember being, in college in the computer lab, and there were a couple of Chinese students, and they were speaking Chinese, except every now and then I would hear words like hard disk, floppy, right in the middle. And it's like, I think it's similar to that, right? Where I think, for example, if you're speaking about computer stuff to another Norwegian, you're not going to use the native word for browser. You're going to say browser, I think.
Also, I don't think those Chinese students are using the word floppy anymore.
No, this is, I dated myself.
We've retired.
But on the plus side, I did not say punch card. So, there is that.
So I guess maybe you don't. I was picturing these languages as peers, but maybe instead you have this hierarchy, right? Like, I want to be predominantly English speaking, but my secondary language is Norwegian, and therefore it will also look for words there, but on a slightly lower priority. Is that the kind of heuristic you could apply when you're analyzing the language model?
Well, these are, in some sense, still open-ended questions. Mm-hmm. We know there are several answers, and a lot of it really depends on the marketplace, that what user like, user's degree of tolerating failure mode of prediction. So if you, let's say you mixed two languages and you meant a word in one language, but another language kicks in, that's not what you intended. Some people may have higher tolerance to that and others just felt it's unacceptable.
Where do you think that the n-gram model meets its limitation?
Actually, can we define n-gram and bigram just for people that aren't language experts?
That's
maybe
right.
It's just me. But
So if you just have a list of words, that's a lexicon that defines the legitimate word list or vocabulary. That's, in some sense, it's a simplest form of a language model. Next level is that you have frequencies to go with which word is more likely than the other. That become a unigram model. And then you look at every pairs of word that become bigram models, and you can go from there to 3 trigram, 4 gram, up to n-gram.
So that usually gives you the prediction for any new word, what the previous word or more was.
Yeah. The challenge is usually the higher level you go, it already become an impossible combination.
Yeah. Well, so it's like the
large
the
number. So you'll have to have some sort of back off. That is when your previous trained model does not know this particular combination. You still don't want to say that's impossible. You still want to assign certain probability to that.
Yeah.
And that become a smoothing problem, so-called. Yeah.
Yeah. So what I was thinking is that is sort of just looking at statistics. Like, what's likely after this is, then there's some possibilities. But what about going to a bit deeper AI? right? Something like TensorFlow, where it's looking at maybe more than just the last N words, but it's actually trying to understand what you're talking about. And that certain things are much more likely in this context based on things you've said previously, for example. Have you done any thinking about that? Or do you think there's any promise to that, to having basically a little AI that is, intermediary?
Much more than me, there's the whole field of AI, especially natural language processing, has been thinking about things like this and exploring different techniques that's going beyond Ngrind model.
That's what the new, is it Inbox or Gmail is doing, right? Where you get the smart replies where it looks at the incoming message and it guesses what you would want to respond.
Yeah, I don't know specifically what techniques you'd use, but most likely it's using some form of neural network that represents the context in a more hidden fashion.
Right.
So it's not explicitly this word or that word, but more how likely the sequence is.
Seems like the same sort of thing that the search folks would have to deal with, right? Like natural language. Someone's going to enter a bunch of random words and you need to figure out what they actually meant by this.
Key difference, though, is in some sense, search has more regularities than language. Because you may say anything. Language is just so flexible. You can say so many things. There are common connections between words, but there are also a great deal of flexibility. You can express endless ideas and thoughts. But search, you are likely to search for a particular question, place, person, and so on and so forth that has a stronger kind of a regularity or distribution to go with it. But that also is backed up by a huge amount of knowledge in the cloud, which keyboard usually doesn't go that far.
Right. Do you overlap, or are the problems that you're solving on a constrained device just so different that there's not as much crossover? Right. Like you're also doing interpretation of user intention.
I can give you an example. Actually, this is already launched, so not many people probably have discovered it. When you use a Google keyboard on Android, you do a gesture. You just type in a word. Let's say meal pitas. We all know what meal pitas is. But for people who are not living in this San Francisco Bay Area, they would never come across that word. Therefore, in a very large language model training corpus, that word may not be in that corpus or may not appear frequently enough to be selected. So therefore, a relatively small language model does not know that word. So if you gesture type meal pitas, the keyboard wouldn't give you the word meal pitas, and it will give you some random words that some sort related to that shape of that word on a QWERTY keyboard. But today, if you gesture type meal pitas into Google search bar, the search bar would actually also return a set of results. And one of them said, did you mean meal pitas? Because that gesture was actually sent into the cloud, and Google has a very similar decoding engine running on a much larger language model, in fact, our search language model, and then returns, do you mean meal pitas instead of this funny word that's in your vocabulary, on the device, in keyboard, but not...
So there's a blend
of... That's not on the device, yeah.
Right. So there's a blend of two different models where if you were gesture typing a Gmail on your device, it would not come up with the right suggestion.
Right.
But if you're gesture typing, same keyboard, same device, but you're doing it into the search bar, we're actually taking advantage of central search resources.
Then it goes back to what we talked about earlier, personalization. That is, next time, even if you write it in Gmail on device, it still know that word because you have written it once before.
Right. Yeah. If you corrected to that word, then that's a piece of information we glommed onto. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. And again, to define another term, when you say corpus, you mean dead words. Is that right?
Means a body of text.
Okay. All right.
So I swear that at least I've been impressed in the past with it auto-completing cities like San Francisco, like it knew that. How do you have a sense of how many... Like, what is the size of a locale have to be before we will include it? Or, what is the minimum size of something for it to be included in our default model?
Or is it just the frequency of usage whatever model you processed, right?
Maybe Bay Area is pretty high in the training set.
And not so much.
Yes.
Yeah.
could be.
I think those are still evolving topic. You think each signal alone, like whom you're writing to, what message you reply to, the header of the email, the location you are at, all this potentially have some information about what you are going to write. But on the other hand, the strength of each is also limited. And in the long run, the trick is to actually manage and merge all these things, signals together. But for now, there are a lot more rooms for improvement for the basics, basic technology.
One signal
so
that
not using that much signals yet.
Yeah. Well, one signal that I think you must have added a while ago because I was really impressed by it is that it understands all the contact names on my phone, right? Because, you know, I have it can autocomplete Norwegian names, for example. And they must be because they must be looking on my phone for sure, I'm guessing.
Oh, the contacts is part of
that's really super useful,
yes.
Especially in texting apps. Is there a way for app developers to somehow, if I have a text field in my app and I know some context words that users may want to enter, is there a way for app developers to opt in to participate in keyboard completion or no?
Basically inject overlays into the language model.
Yeah.
Again, these are good directions, but the challenge is to some degree privacy. That is, or the relationship between app and OS or app and keyboard.
Yeah.
So would an app want to expose everything you write to it and feed that back to a keyboard, which obviously is owned by the user, but potentially can be used also for other apps or when you get back to it.
Yeah.
But from a user convenience and interaction efficiency point of view, again, the more we record users' history and the context, the better it is.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, there's a...
So are you incrementally updating the model as the user is typing, or is this sort of like a batch thing you do occasionally, or how does that work?
Right now, we're not doing much of anything because there's no API to say, well, now Gmail will spit your words back to me so I can use these words in the future. We don't have that API today.
Cool. So you just have the ability where you will auto-log a word when the user corrects it back to it, right. Milpitas or whatever.
Right. Or you tap one letter at a time.
Yeah.
For OOV word, and it would be learned for future use.
Right.
So if I want to teach the keyboard something, I should type it out?
Yeah.
Okay.
Actually, it'd be good if you just turned on that capability between like the hours of, 10 and midnight on weekend nights, and then you would end up with basically a corpus of drunk typing words. I think that would be good.
You only drink at night? Is that what you're saying?
I'm just saying, in general, in society, I was trying to make a general observation. Of course I would.
There are third-party keyboards that does a much more aggressive job in learning users' typing. And there's problems, challenges with that. Sometimes people type very quickly and just didn't bother to correct mistakes. And all those will be learned as part of the vocabulary of the keyboard. And then in the future, you don't even know which one is a correct form anymore. There's that danger.
Can you do grammar correction too?
Generally, in the field of language modeling, that's a reoccurring idea of using rules that other than a simple ngram.
Yep.
Usually, they have some benefit, but also in a limited size or scale. When you have a very large scale, usually ngram still works better or just simpler and more efficient, cleaner to do.
It's a small step from green squigglies to a clippy. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but I'm thinking not even that. Like, you should not be allowed to type the letters you are. You know, it should just change it to your, in my opinion.
Although, if you want to type it, that's fine. I don't want to see it.
Yeah, maybe that's what we need to do. We need to take these models and make a Twitter client that takes the tweets as actual keyboard input and it corrects it into something readable. Right? It's as if that was the raw data to the gesture typer, and then, okay, now give me English back, please.
I have some colleagues. I'd like to do that on IMs, actually. When I speak to them, they are the most articulate and correct and academic people I know, and then I see IMs from them, and I cannot parse them. It's like they switch into a different language model just to do IMs.
And then there's the PM language, right, with learnings and all these things, right? We could also autocorrect those.
I have an ask here.
Yeah. But all these are still evolving, and again, there's benefit, known benefits in lots of research shows that if you make the language model adapt to a particular domain or particular person, it will be stronger for that person or for that domain. But there's also a lot of risks, especially in terms of false predictions and so on. So it's still evolving a topic. But in the meantime, just the basic technology in terms of the UI design, in terms of the how do you decode a gesture that is quite sloppy, but still get to the right word. It's still evolving, and there's more more benefit to be made in there.
That's good. I already have learned sort of I think the minimum curve I have to draw for certain words. So I've been using it for several years now to the point that I'm cheating as much as I can get away with, and I think I'm learning constantly like how much is too far away from the real target. And I keep staying right within that boundary.
That's interesting.
I want to know the trick to tell it off instead of. I keep tripping over common misinterpretations, and I can't figure out when it's
right.
Picking one.
So this
other.
Brings back to some of the initial ideas and motivations when I got involved in originating this paradigm. That is, the goal is to really invent a new way of writing, where the representation of each word is relatively unique and relatively simple, and that is a tall order we still haven't achieved. That is, if we are allowed to move the keys around on the keyboard, so the keyboard become a much better system at defining each word, and then you can maximize the distance between words. So that way, statistically, each word has the least amount of requirement in terms of movement and in terms of the complexity of writing that word. So that way, you can be even more free at expressing yourself. And that really was one of the initial goals. But the challenge is learning. How do you get people to learn a new layout?
Well, what if you went instead to a... What's the word? To a sound system, right? Where there's like so you're basically, the keys aren't representing letters, they're representing sounds.
Phonetic?
So there should be,
phonetic,
that's the word, right. Thank you. What if there was like a phonetic keyword? So the number of keys is, I think, not much larger than the number of letters we have today. You could express pretty much anything, maybe fairly uniquely. That might work.
Although
but it'd be hard to spell words that way. You would be spelling the letter sounds.
I would hate that. For every sound, I'd have to go, what does that sound like?
There's probably a reason no one's done this. It's probably a really bad idea. Or maybe someone has done it. There's probably 15,000 apps that already do it.
But it's an interesting idea. That is, what is the right level of elements you use to build up a word?
Yeah.
Chinese basically use a Chinese character corresponds to about between a word and a syllable. So that's a higher level than letters, but that's just too many. So there would be thousands of Chinese characters, common characters, and clearly making a Chinese keyboard with individual Chinese characters would be too large.
Especially when you get really small, you know, you can't tell quite the difference between the little letter forms when there's a few pixels apart.
Somewhere in between, like all shorthand writing systems are based on syllables, or certainly higher level than individual letters at the Roman alphabet level, in order to get speed. But then it means you have to learn a new system, and that is quite a challenge that most users wouldn't be willing to accept. So even just rearranging letters, we still use letters, but rearranging letters, so the shape, that's why I called this paradigm shape writing for a period of time in early days of its invention and development. That is, you want each word to be a fairly unique shape that is highly memorable and fairly simple to articulate. If you look at QWERTY, this is back to Chad's question, that is, if of they are just one pixel apart and they share exactly the same shape, more or less the same shape, and the they both are very common. So and often even language model cannot resolve that. Like IN and ON, they both are very common. And
that's
very
where you need the grammar, the grammar layer on top, right? Where there's really no other way.
Right. To a degree. Even grammar doesn't necessarily resolve that.
Huh. Yeah, I wondered about that. I wondered whether n-grams were supposed to solve this, because sometimes it'll do an if instead of an of instead of an off or whatever, and it is not the word that should have followed the previous word. So I would have thought the model would have addressed that, but there's
maybe it's trained by people that don't know what they're doing. There's a lot of because I assume we're not taking like correct models and starting with that,
we're
right?
Just
If you're a terrible speller and we're basically training the model on your own writings, it's going to keep perpetuating your mistakes, right?
That would be a problem. Yeah.
Maybe we should just give people like 0 and 1 and let them type UTF-8. That would certainly be unique.
In fact, Chinese telegram system was strictly based on a numeric code that the operators actually just have to remember the code.
And
the
what was the size of their dictionary?
Thousands of words. Thousands of characters. Thousands of characters. Thousands of Chinese characters.
Wow, that's...
Yeah.
So I just finished reading The Martian, and they use the ASCII system there with sort of the code for using numbers for doing it. So we could do that. It looks really tedious. I'd really like to not do that.
That's actually what makes this area really interesting. That is, fundamentally, we're trying to ideally invent a system that is optimized for efficiency. But the challenge is that most users would not be willing to spend today's time for the benefit of next week or next month to learn a new system. And this generally in UI design always face this challenge. How do we just design a system that can accommodate both ease of learning in the beginning as well as long-term efficiencies is really the central challenge. And that's also a key idea behind this paradigm of gesture typing, because the keyboard ultimately is really just a map or guide for your motor movement. But the more you use it, the more you remember the shape implicitly and you get faster at writing it. And that's where you can, as you say, cut corners and be more rounded off, but still get the word right.
Yeah. Until I guess I type a word and then suddenly the model changes and now I got a better match.
So what's the crossover between typing and gestures? Like at what point in the system do they combine? Like I would like to understand what the process is going from, you know, user input into actually popping a word up in the, you know, the text view or whatever.
So it's more or less used the same so-called spatial model, but the spatial model have different features in picking out the touch points versus the gesture stroke into likely sequence of letters for later stage decoding. So in essence, the technologies are actually similar, again, except the features they looks at. So in essence, the difference is not that big. The bigger difference is the user behavior. That is, the continuous gesture is more explicitly representing a shape, and that's more memorable to users. You can, like Android lock screen, when you use a pattern, imagine those dots are numbers to tap. It's just more easier to remember as an explicit shape.
And easier to figure out what someone else's code is because you can see it on their
screen. Yeah, we're not allowed to use those. The core policy doesn't let us use
it. I wonder if you could look at where the keyboard sits on the screen, if you could tell what words they type over and over and over again.
In fact, but QWERTY is so ambiguous, it's very hard to tell.
Yeah.
Because the rationale of QWERTY is designed in such a way that in the early, in the 1860s, the inventors such as Christopher Sholes wanted to make their prototype not get jammed together. So you type one letter on one side, the next letter is likely to be on the other side. But this means that when you do gesture typing, you go left and right and left and right. They all zigzag in very similar right. fashion. So it's actually just possibly the worst layout for gesture typing.
Although, so
it gives you more unique shapes, though.
I mean, it seems like it's a workaround for the technology of the time, but it was also good for the hands, right? Like I can be much faster if both of my hands are involved rather than, you know, going between the pinky and the fourth finger constantly.
In fact, that's the alternation between left and right. It was a major facilitator to speed typing mm-hmm. with two hands. And that's why efforts like Dvorak keyboard had a higher hurdle than they think to overcome. That is, you can do better in terms of assignments of letters to more efficient fingers. But the fact that QWERTY does a very frequent alternation pretty much took a lot of the potential gain that from further optimization for two-handed or 10-finger right. typing.
But then the model changed where now we enter with one finger instead of 10.
Exactly. Although we have been doing also work on you can gesture left and right and mixed gesture on both sides, and that potentially can also accommodate the QWERTY layout. But a better way to go about it in the long run is still having a new layout that is optimized for gesture typing. And again, and I think learning is the challenge in there. How do you get users to learn a new layout, maybe in the form of games? We actually have done these kind of things before. Personally, I could gesture type on a layout we designed years ago called Atomic, much faster than I could ever on QWERTY. But again, that requires hours of learning that most people probably are not willing to invest.
You say on tablet, you know, so I like gesture typing. On tablets, though, I don't, because there's so much distance involved. Yeah. You know, my arm gets worn out, and I feel like I would. You know, he's laughing.
You really need to go to the gym.
Yeah. You know, it's back and forth. And then, you know, if the screen starts getting, the friction gets higher and higher. Right. So it's just like, it's not great. And I would almost prefer it if that keyboard was small. It was phone size instead of taking up. I know that for people who are actually doing the, you know, peck and type, that it's nice to have a large keyboard. But for someone who's swiping, it's not great. So, you know, that would be a feature request for you. The other thing I was going to say is that I became a lot faster with gesture typing when I learned that I don't have to actually hit the space bar between words, right? So I kept word, space. And when I realized you don't have to do it automatically, that was a great discovery. So do you have any analytics on how many people know that?
Actually, Chet mentioned this to me about 2 or 3 years ago at TGIF. He always want to tap people's shoulders. Well, you don't have to do that, you know, because he see people actually, gesture, type, gesture, tap, yeah, gesture, tap, and back and forth.
You just get a much better rhythm when you skip that, rather for some reason.
Right. Also, it's so the average length of English word is English word is 4.7 letters. So that's about 20% of the time you're actually typing on the space if you have to do it. But a great advantage of gesture typing is that every time you lift a gesture, it can give you a space for free.
Why don't you change the caption on the space bar so that it just says, when someone is swiping, that just, you know, not necessary?
Again, like how do you, this is, again, we have a lot of good UI features that people never know. Shortcuts and... Yeah.
Well, what I'm saying is that this would make it discoverable. Like, I swipe a word, and I see now the space button. It's not saying space. It's saying, you know, not necessary or something like that, right? So I would see right away that, oh, what does that mean?
Right. There are actually interesting corner cases. When you do give a space, it become problematic in some use cases. We have looked into this. There are pros and cons.
If someone pauses in the middle of a word, for example?
But especially when you do a punctuation, like a period that doesn't require space between the letter and so on. Yeah. And there's also, in case of, you want it to be also compatible with the touch typing mode, the tap typing mode as well.
Oh, yeah. So I did not advocate removing it, which would have been even better, right? Like if it's just not there, you would go, oh, I mean, and then you would discover it. But it's probably good to have it there.
I can tell you another feature I'm sure most people don't know about. It's also just kind of useful. You sometimes gesture into a word and you realize, oh, I made a mistake. Mm-hmm. This one is a bad one.
Yeah.
If you lift your finger, it will give you a word that's not intended.
Yeah.
And then you have to go to find the backspace key and tap on that,
yeah,
remove it,
yeah,
and then you have to do it again.
Yeah.
In fact, if you just swipe your finger out of the keyboard,
so in the middle of the
this one got screwed up. That's abandon it.
It's like the editor swipe for delete this
exactly
word.
And it's very, very useful. But how, like, you wouldn't get users' attention to tell user, well, you can do things like that. You can write tutorials or various things, but people don't pay attention to those.
Yep. Maybe inside the keyboard settings, you could have like a tutorial thing, right? People can go through and learn tips and tricks.
Which they won't run.
Which way they won't, yeah.
Whenever I see a tutorial, like we do this now, you know, you first get a device and you go into it for the first time and it's like, hey, I'm the, and I'm like, go away.
Yes.
No, that's not why, it should not be the first thing on the keyboard, but I'm more thinking when you go into the keyboard settings, it might have, you know, no, you don't think so?
Yeah, I just think people won't, A, how would the tutorial be discoverable, which is the whole problem we're facing. And then B, I don't think they would run it because they're always going to have something better to do than run a keyboard tutorial.
Mm.
Yeah. Just it's better for them, just like fiber, but not very tasty.
Mm. Yeah. But again, this is just, in my view, a general challenge in UI design, but in keyboard in particular, that is, how do you design more efficient UI that is discoverable and learnable in use without requiring upfront learning? And that's a challenge everywhere.
Yeah, well, I work on a UI tool that absolutely you have to be an expert to use, right? I mean, you don't have to, but there's so much hidden power.
The power of command lines.
We cannot put everything that you can do in Android Studio into a menu, right? It would just
It would be too tedious to drill down and to have everything to be display driven.
Yeah. Plus, what would Chet and I talk about when guests don't show up? Last week we talked about the tools because our guests couldn't make it. So.
I see. So, but gesture typing has this idea built in to some degree. That is, you can look at the keyboard that give you a chance of rehearsal, but the goal is to eventually evolve that to be more and more of a memory-driven process. And that, again, also has a hurdle in terms of the QWERTY layout of not very friendly to that idea. So all these are still evolving.
Yeah.
So a lot of things... Actually, I should say my overwhelming impression listening to this conversation is that in research, there's still a lot of work to do.
Yes. And this research is also, in a way, in the wild, in the marketplace, among users. That is, you know, we are accepting more and more from the machine side of initiative or predictions. I think only a few years ago, if you say, you know, the UI would proactively prepare something for you, most users wouldn't like that. But today, actually, a lot of things are active or proactive on the user on the system side already. And people have greater tolerance, but also the quality gets better. As the quality gets better, people would actually want those features. And then can evolve with the user.
So then how do we find out the answers to some of these things? Like so many of the questions that came up today were, you know, there are explorations into this. It's not clear what's best for users or whether this would work or there's research being done. How do you get the answers? Like, do you work with user testing groups? Do you do prototypes?
Yeah, we do user studies ourselves. We also publish in the academic community on some of the early results. But the larger experiments requires deployment or larger trials to know. And these are, you know, a difficult balance in terms of how much you push for something that users are not ready or the technology is not ready, and how much you stay with the status quo. So you just have to find that balance.
It seems like we get a lot of benefit in our world from early testing of features just because we have a large enough community at, you know, the company or the department or whatever where we can do early testing with real users. They may be a weird demographic of users, But we have real users using the devices and using the applications before they go out. So there's some benefit of getting some pseudo real world testing without the possible risk of, you know, forcing a feature down users' throats that, you know, is not appropriate.
Right. And you can see experimenting in a way, inbox versus the regular Gmail UI. They are quite different, but we managed to have both and let user choose and even switch back and forth.
Yep.
So there's ways to push innovation that way.
Right. And I guess with Android, users are free to choose their own keyboards as well.
I have to say, being in Android wisdom very early on, we made IMF, that is the input method framework that enables anybody to write a system-wide input method that's only adopted by other platforms much later. That really helped paradigms like gesture typing to take off. It really enabled innovation because that means any startup companies or other companies other than Google can experiment with real users at scale. Ultimately, that's where innovation really matters.
Right. And now the keyboard that used to be part of the OS is now bundled as a separate app, right? So you can use the Google Gesture keyboard back to what? Gingerbread? ICS?
There are two versions of keyboards from Google. One is AOSP keyboard, and the other is Google keyboard. They are similar, but not exactly the same.
Okay.
There are more advanced features in
and the
Google
one
keyboard.
That the non AOSP one, does that one, can you install it from the Play Store?
Yes.
So it's unbundled. Okay.
Yes. Yep. In fact, that itself, in some sense, is a discoverability issue. I'll just give you an example of a recent study I did with a former student of mine who's now a professor at Cambridge University, and his student. Together we ran a study by looking at how users learn and migrate from regular touch typing keyboard to a gesture keyboard mode in the same keyboard. So they actually download the Google keyboard and use it in the beginning, surprisingly, still a very small minority of users actually know about gesture typing. So in this study, which lasted about a month long, every day they got prompt a few times to type a few sentences in the middle of everyday activity. So that way we can test real mobile use. Like they might be walking, or they might be just sitting down, maybe standing in line. So they will type a few words or gesture type a few words. This got prompted 10 times a day. And we observe how much how fast they could type with each mode. And you can see clear migration over time. They would use more and more and faster with gesture typing. At the end of the study, every user switched to gesture typing as their everyday use case.
And were they told about this feature, or they discovered it on their own?
This was a study to observe, again, the learning curve of gesture typing versus touch typing.
But was there teaching involved in that learning?
They have to download the app and download the Google keyboard, but also download a separate app that measures their typing speed and prompts to them. So that is, they were told, they were part of the study. It's an explicit study.
But that study was saying, we want to see if you use gesture typing, not just type this word. Because I'm thinking some users are like, oh, type it, and they would just type out the words. I'm wondering how they came about discovering, oh, I can drag my finger. Because we don't tell them anywhere, do we?
If you go to Play Store to download Google Keyboard.
Oh, there we show them.
There we show it.
I see.
But a lot of times, the Google Keyboard was pre-installed with, for example, Nexus devices, and people wouldn't get a chance.
Yep.
And again, you can, the out-of-box experience, you wanted that to be as short as possible. So you don't want, that seems to be an opportunity to teach them, oh, you can do this or that, but people don't have the patience to do that. That's, again, that's a challenge to say how we manage users' attention, but not demanding too much of it.
Right.
So I think we're winding down here. I would say, what excites you most about doing research at Google or in this area? Like, it seems like it's sort of an infinite space to be in. Like, not even just keyboards, but just finding the way to allow users to do things quickly. Right. So, what's your focus? What are you doing there?
I think we have got a lot out of basic touchscreen based mobile computing paradigm. I think there's a lot more we can do, and that really excites me. That is, how do we find a way to increase the interaction bandwidth, interaction efficiency, but without imposing a great deal of learning on the user? I think we can see this happening in the industry to some degree, but it's just there's a lot more innovation to come. That excites me. And Google, of course, has a very large user base that who can both benefit and also innovate with us. And we have a huge ecosystem, and we have many, many platforms for invention and innovation. That really is, and of course, a lot of fantastic Googlers who are really savvy in technologies as well as in design.
Great. Look forward to more. All right. Thanks very much.
Thank you. It's fun.